Good evening from New York, and thank you for tuning in to today's program. The New York City Bar presents commercial arbitration in Latin America, what U.S. parties may encounter in arbitrations and or enforcing awards in the region. My name is Breka Rangachari, and I serve on the City Bar's Inter-American Affairs Committee. Our goal is to provide an array of programs covering hot topics in the Americas, to engage, to bring us together, and to offer you key considerations that you can take away as you build your best practices. We're going to speak today on a variety of topics, definitions between international versus domestic matters, notable distinctions in some jurisdictions, as well as what it means to be a commercial matter, arbitrability and public order, autonomy and lack thereof of arbitral proceedings across jurisdictions, enforcement, annulment, set aside, alongside key cases offering precedential force, and even amparo proceedings and their role and impact on efficiency. We'll also touch upon news and trends that may be familiar to you. And to that end, please pose your questions within the Q&A function in Zoom. We endeavor towards robust dialogue and not monologues, and you will help us to that end. I have the distinct pleasure of introducing today this evening's conductor, Alejandro Garro. Professor Garro is adjunct professor of law and senior research scholar of the Parker School of Foreign and Comparative Law at Columbia University. He is also honorary professor at the National University of Buenos Aires, UBA, and he focuses on comparative and international commercial law. He is a consummate scholar, particularly on comparative contract law and Latin American systems. And so there is nobody better suited to lead this discussion today. Two administrative points for you. One, the session is being recorded. Two, again, to increase audience participation, the Zoom function, Q&A, post your questions there. We'll be pushing you to keep posting your questions there throughout the session. As you consider the various permutations U.S. parties may encounter as they hop jurisdictions within LATAM, allow me to spotlight the chair of the City Bar's Inter-American Affairs Committee, Michael Fernandez. He is an associate at Winston & Strawn. His leadership makes events like this one possible. I also thank the City Bar team that is running our Zoom platform, and particularly Kevin Mankiop. And finally, the New York City Bar's Arbitration Committee and its chair, Steve Skolnick, for co-sponsoring this event with us and bringing you all here today. With that, I turn the floor to Professor Garro. Please, onwards.
Thank you very much, Rika. Thank you very much, and good evening and good afternoon to everybody. My job would be probably just simply to moderate these very interesting panelists that are going to be from five different jurisdictions, giving us somehow a diverse but yet a very interesting and pointed discussion about what they find in their own jurisdictions of most interesting, especially from an outside Latin American perspective, where Latin America is generally considered to be in block. And you will find, of course, that variations from Latin American jurisdiction to jurisdictions are very relevant, as you will see through the panelists today. So I think that without any much, I would just simply, in the words of thanks that Rika mentioned, I would also mention the co-sponsoring committees here, the International Dispute Resolution Committee and the International Law Committee, which are also sponsoring this event, as well as the Inter-American Bar Association and the New York International Arbitration Center, represented by Rika here. So without any more ado, I will start briefly introducing you the speakers. All of them are accomplished practitioners and academics in complex litigation and arbitration disputes, domestic, international, investment, and commercial. So I'm going to be very brief, and I will start by Dr. Julio Cesar Rivera, who himself is a partner at Marval O'Farrell Mairal, which is a leading law firm in Buenos Aires, and also a professor of law at the University of San Andres in Buenos Aires, and part of the professor of the global program at NYU. I will just introduce Julio then for him to give us a perspective on Argentine develops in arbitration. Julio.
Thank you very much, Alejandro, for the presentation, and second, Michael and Enrica for this invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Alejandro, if I may, I will share the screen. Can you see the screen, the presentation?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So as Alejandro said, the idea of this brief presentation is to introduce some of the most idiosyncratic aspects of Argentine arbitration law. The first important thing to understand is that Argentina has multiple sources of arbitration regulation. So it's very important to understand which regulations apply to domestic and which regulation apply to international arbitration. International arbitration is quite simple. It's only governed by the International Commercial Arbitration Act, enacted in 2018, based on UNCITRAL model law with very, very minor modifications, together with, of course, with international conventions ratified by Argentina, including New York and Panama conventions. Domestic arbitration is a bit more complex because of the interpretation of the constitution and certain federalism issues, Argentina has a national regulation of arbitration in the civil and commercial law code, limited in principle to arbitration agreements, the definition, form, content, effects of the arbitration agreement, the arbitrability, the type of dispute that can be subject to arbitration, etc. And also, complementing the National Civil and Commercial Code, we also have procedural regulation of arbitration in every province in the procedural codes. Basically, the most important aspects of this procedural regulation is that they regulate the grounds of annulment for any award issued in that jurisdiction. So in domestic arbitration, basically here we have a summary. We have two main sources, national civil and commercial code applicable in the whole country and the procedural codes applicable in national jurisdiction and in local jurisdictions. International arbitration, as I said, is much more simple. We only have a single act together with the applicable international conventions. Having said that, it is important to understand the definition of international and commercial arbitration in the International Commercial Arbitration Act, because there are some differences with UNCITRAL model law. With respect to the notion of international, it is important to understand that Argentina doesn't consider an arbitration to be international simply because the parties want it. There must be an objective international element in the parties' relationship. So we have a discussion among Argentinian commentators and scholars with respect to this provision, because Article 3 of the law said that an arbitration is international if the place of arbitration is outside the state in which the parties have their place of business. So the question is, okay, parties may not agree to have an international arbitration, but they may agree to have the place of arbitration outside of Argentina, and that is an international arbitration. Some commentators reject this interpretation, and they say that when the law states that when the place of arbitration is outside the state in which the parties have their places of business, they are only referring to foreign domestic cases in which the party selected Argentina as a seat, that the law doesn't regulate the opposite situation, a domestic Argentine dispute with a seat outside Argentina. Actually, many commentators think that if we have a domestic case with a foreign seat, that award may not be enforced in Argentina. So this is a difference with model law. The second difference, which is much more delicate, is the definition of commercial. Argentine law defines commercial relationship as any contractual or non-contractual relationship governed by private law or predominantly by it. So the notion of commercial is premised on the applicable law, whether it's private law, basically civil and commercial law, or it is public law, administrative law. So the definition of commercial is not based on the commercial nature of the underlying transaction. And why is this relevant? This is relevant with respect to contract governed by public law. which are most of the contracts in which the Argentine state or state-owned companies are parties. So with respect to these type of cases, the International Commercial Arbitration Act doesn't apply. And so the only regulation that we have for arbitration of disputes governed by public law is our outdated procedural code from the 60s. So in this regard, Argentina is a very unattractive seat for arbitration of disputes with the state parties. And this is related to my next issue. Is Argentina a good seat for international arbitration? My answer is it depends. It depends on the type of dispute. If it is a dispute between private parties, I can say that nowadays Argentine commercial courts have developed a very, very friendly and modern interpretation of arbitration laws in Argentina, even before the enactment of the International Arbitration Act. On the other hand, administrative courts still have a very hostile interpretation of arbitration, and they systematically tend to favor the state or state-owned companies or state parties. So the answer would depend a lot on the type of dispute you have. One typical problem in Latin America is constitutional law. I always say that when I hear the word constitutional law in arbitration, I always get scared. And why? I mean, even though, I mean, I used to teach constitutional law for many, many years, it tends to be used to interfere with arbitration proceedings. In Argentina, some constitutional standards traditionally used to review judicial decisions from lower courts, such as arbitrariness, have in some exceptional cases, have influenced the interpretation of the grounds of annulment. But to be fair, most of Argentinian courts have rejected this interpretation, and they say that the notion of arbitrariness shouldn't be used to interpret the grounds of annulment. And finally, my last point, I mean, we, as Alejandro said, between 5 and 7 minutes, arbitrability is governed by national laws. There is no regulation of arbitrability in the International Commercial Arbitration Act. And this is a problem because some of the disputes that may not be subject to arbitration according to Argentinian law, for example, are consumer disputes, adhesion contracts, labor disputes. The most problematic category for international arbitration is adhesion contracts. However, commercial courts, again, have said that the mere fact that we have an adhesion contract doesn't automatically entail that the arbitration agreement is null, that there must be a disparity of power between the parties to annul that arbitration agreement. So basically, in a nutshell, these are some of the most idiosyncratic aspects of Argentinian arbitration law. Thank you, Alejandro.
Thank you, Julio, and I think that you already put the ground for some aspects that are probably going to be touching upon other countries. I think what's interesting now that we are moving to Brazil from Argentina, you will mention about the different regulations in the provincial codes of civil procedure. Now we're moving to the largest country in the region, which has one code of civil procedure for the whole country. And then we will move to Mexico, which has one civil code for each one, but one commercial code for the whole country. I think that these are the differences that we want the audience to be acquainted with in Latin America. They all don't speak with the same voice on many aspects. Let me introduce you to Diogo Chiufo Carneiro, who is a partner at Viacara Abogados. And Diogo is also a partner and the head of the arbitration group at this firm. And he also co-lead the litigation group. He holds a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from the Catholic University of Sao Paulo, as well as an LLM from Columbia Law School. Diogo, we look forward to hearing you.
Thank you, Alejandro. I would just initiate with a protest, because as a Brazilian, I don't like to go after Argentina. Never, neither in football or even in this presentation. But as the moderator is from Argentina as well, I will accept this time, okay? But anyway, well, Brazil does not have a long tradition in arbitration. Our Arbitration Act is from 1996, but there was really no arbitration until 2001, because there was a big discussion in Brazil whether or not the Arbitration Act was constitutional. So only in 2001, the Supreme Court rendered a decision, a 7-4 decision, saying that arbitration was constitutional. So arbitration really started in Brazil in 2001, so 19 years ago. So we are still a teenager when it comes to arbitration. Well, we only have commercial arbitration. Brazil did not sign the Washington Convention. Well, actually, Fernando Henrique Cardoso have signed 14 BITs, but none of them are into force, become into force, because the Congress did not approve those BITs. So we only have commercial arbitration. We don't have investment arbitration. And we only have the Brazilian Arbitration Act, as I will call it here, which is the only piece of legislation in Brazil regarding arbitration. Of course, there are some small provisions in the commercial code or in the civil code, but those are only small provisions. Basically, everything is governed by the Brazilian Arbitration Act. And our Arbitration Act was inspired by the model law, but has significant difference from the model law. Yeah, I will mention some important difference. First, well, the Brazilian Arbitration Act deals with arbitrability, something that the model law does not address. And we have the rule here in Brazil is that for you to be able to render some dispute to the arbitration, it must be a waivable right that you have. So it's an open concept, and there's still some debates on which kind of scope can you bring to arbitration. But in 2015, there is a new piece of legislation that adapted the Brazilian Arbitration Act to make it very clear that, for instance, state-owned companies can enter into arbitrations, even though it's not a waivable right for a state-owned company per se. But anyway, this is one difference. Another difference is that we don't have a definition of international arbitration. The Brazilian Arbitration Act will govern any arbitration, domestic or international, as long as the seat of arbitration is within Brazil. So, and that's the only difference that you have from a national to an international arbitration is enforcement of the award. If you have a seat of arbitration outside Brazil, then before enforcing the award, you need to go through a domestication process in the Superior Court of Justice. If the seat of arbitration is within Brazil, there is no need for a recognition of the award. You can enforce immediately. And that leads to a different angle, because you can have an arbitration, the seat of arbitration being São Paulo, but you can have applying the law of Argentina, for instance, or applying New York law to that arbitration, and you would be able to enforce immediately because the seat of arbitration is São Paulo. So you can have a foreign arbitrator applying a foreign law, but as long as the seat of arbitration is in Brazil, you can enforce the arbitrable award immediately. A third difference is about grounds and procedure for challenging the arbitrator. The Brazilian Arbitration Act does not say a lot about this. It only says that an arbitrator has the same duties and the same responsibility as a judge. So usually to challenge an arbitrator, I use the same grounds as to challenge a judge, which is a little bit weird because they have differences, of course. And so this is some aspect that the case law has developed a lot here in Brazil. And not always in a good way. For instance, I mentioned to you the famous Abengoa case, which was an arbitration applying New York law. The seat of arbitration was in New York. And after the arbitration was coming to an end, the losing party filed to set aside the award in the Southern District of New York and lose that case. The court in New York said, well, there is no grounds to set aside the award. The award is valid. When the winning party came to Brazil, they have to domesticate the award because the seat of arbitration was in New York, and they have to go to the Superior Court of Justice. And the Superior Court of Justice found two things. First, they have the power to do not domesticate the award, even though it was not set aside by the court of the seat of arbitration. They have that power. And the second finding is that an arbitrator failed to disclose that his firm had some cases of the winning party, and therefore the Superior Court of Justice denied recognition for that award. It was a case, actually the chairman of that case was of the arbitration was David Rifkin from the Beauvoirs. And what happened is that the Beauvoirs did provide some service from a company affiliated to a Bengoa. But those were just small cases that like less than 1% of the revenues of the firm. Yeah. So the Brazilian Superior Court of Justice did not take into consideration the IBA guidelines on conflict of interest, because the IBA guidelines says that, well, if the revenues of the clients are insignificant, it's a green list. You don't need even to disclose that fact. You only need to disclose it's an orange list if the revenues are significant. So the Superior Court of Justice ignore the IBA guidelines. It's not mandatory, of course, to apply the IBA guidelines. But anyway, ignore, and did understand that there is a higher standard for conflicts of interest in relation to arbitrator. He had to disclose that fact. And since he failed to disclose, the Superior Court of Justice decided to set aside his award. And there is a new case, like last August, that follows the same path. It's a case from the Court of Appeals of São Paulo. And one of the arbitrators failed to disclose that he has been appointed by the same party in another arbitration. He was the chairman, so he was not appointed by the parties, but he was appointed by one of the parties in another arbitration, and he did not disclose that fact. Again, it's a green list on the IBA guidelines. For the IBA guidelines, for you to have to disclose that fact, you must have been appointed two or more times for the same party. And he was only appointed one time for that party in a case that had no relationship with that arbitration. Anyway, the Court of Appeals decided that he had a duty to disclose. And as he failed to disclose, the Court of Appeal decided to set aside the award. It's an interesting approach because you have the Halliburton case in England. It's a very similar case, but the court in England decided that, well, if you fail to disclose something that you should disclose, you don't need to automatically set aside the award. You need to have more proof that that affects the independence or impartiality of the arbitrators. And last point that I will mention, it's one feature that is it's particular in Brazil, and we do have a lot of shareholder arbitration. I know that in the US, you don't have shareholder arbitration, but here in Brazil, there is a provision on the commercial code allowing for you to insert an arbitration agreement into the bylaws of the company. And even the Brazilian stock exchange has different levels of corporate governance for you to list the company in the Brazilian stock exchange. And for you to reach the higher level, you need to have an arbitration clause on the bylaws. So it's incentivized by the stock exchange, and the stock exchange has initiated an institution called Câmara de Arbitragem do Mercado, specifically to deals with arbitration related to arbitration clause in the company's bylaws. So thank you very much. I hope I have not passed my time too much.
Quite on the contrary. And thank you very much, Diogo, for all this pointed out. There are a couple of issues, at least, that are going to probably come back when we go through the periods of questions. One is what the interesting about the practice with commercial arbitration, one of the parties is a state or an instrumentality of the state. We have heard already Julio pointing out that in Argentina that is being relegated to an obsolete set of rules in the Code of Procedure. The 2015 reforms in Brazil introduced encouraged parties to do that. We would like to ask you about that. And I know that Jesus has some questions about the shareholders' arbitration provisions. We'll come on back to that if we have the time. But now, at this point, I would like to move to Guatemala. Central America, where we have the practice of arbitration within the Central American countries being increasing. And we have fortunate having Paulina Rodriguez from Consortium Legal with us. Consortium Legal is a leading law firm in Guatemala City, and she has been the member and an associate of that firm for quite a number of years, involved in arbitration as well as in litigation. I also want to point out that Paulina is in the list of arbitrators of one of the arbitral institutions in Guatemala, the Cámara de Resolución de Conflictos de la Cámara de Industria, CRESIC, and also of another institution in Guatemala, branch of the Chamber of Commerce, which is the Centro de Conciliación y Arbitraje from the Chamber of Commerce, CENAC. So I think that, Paulina, it's a pleasure to have you here, and please, we were listening to you.
Thank you, Professor, for the words, and thank you, Michael, for the invitation and the New York City Bar for hosting this event. We were waiting this event for too much time, so I'm glad to be here with so distinguished colleagues. And I will discuss into topics that I think that U.S. parties may encounter when having an arbitration in Guatemala. Fortunately, I get to talk about the second topic because the first one is really interesting, and the first topic will be about the annulment of the award. And the second topic I will be addressing will be the constitutional actions of amparo in Guatemala. So regarding the first topic, it is important to mention that Guatemala does has an unsectoral model law with a modification in the annulment of the award. We call this annulment of the award, in Spanish it's called recurso de revisión, and the grounds for setting aside an award are basically the same ones as the unsectoral model law, except that the Guatemalan legislator left down one ground, consisting in the ground in where the party against whom the award is invoked was unable to present his case. So I'm going to share my screen here in order to project what Article 43 of the Guatemalan Arbitration Act states. And basically, that article says that when the court makes a resolution for the annulment of the award, the court can confirm, revoke, or modify the arbitral award. In the case that the court has a revoke or a modification, the court has to make a pronouncement. And during the preparation of this presentation, Jesus precisely made me the question, what does it mean that the court has to make a pronouncement? And recently, our constitutional court in case law in 2015, define what should be understood for the court to make a pronouncement. And it's something really different, something that I think that perhaps U.S. parties haven't heard before. And what shall be interpreted for the court to make a pronouncement is that the judge can make a pronouncement different from the award. Since by the study of the grounds invoked by the party who is setting aside the award, it doesn't have the court sufficient evidence to confirm the award, then the court has to make a new pronouncement by analyzing the merits of the case, since the judge cannot do it in a superficial way and has to reevaluate the arbitral proceeding and render a judgment. So I think that this is very important and very particular in Guatemala, because if the court makes a pronouncement, we have a new judgment. So I think, and what happens in some occasions is that the court does not enter only to analyze the grounds of the setting aside, but it also enters to analyze the merits of the dispute, something that has previously been resolved by the arbitral tribunal. So this increases the probability that courts intervene in subject matters in which parties originally agreed to arbitrate. Awards rendered and set aside in Guatemala, I think that can have a risk of recognition and enforcement in other jurisdictions. Although Guatemala is a contracting state of the New York Convention, and normally an award rendered in Guatemala can be enforced and recognized in other country in which the state is a state country of the New York Convention, if we have an award that was set aside in Guatemala by revocation or modification of the court, I think that that loses totally the characterization of an award, and we have a judgment. So according to that judgment, and according to the definition of the New York Convention, Article 1, Paragraph 2, this judgment made by the court in the annulment of the award is no longer an award, according to the definition of the New York Convention. And I'm going to read it aloud. The term arbitral award shall include not only awards made by arbitrators appointed for each case,
but also those made by permanent arbitral bodies to which the parties have submitted. So according to this definition of arbitral award under the New York Convention, the judgment of the court in Guatemala when it modifies or revokes the award is not a subject matter to be under the scope of the New York Convention. So in other jurisdictions, I'm not sure that we can recognize and enforce that award since it's a judgment. Of course, that will depend of how foreign tribunals will understand what is a judgment. Some may say that it's part of the award. Some others may say that it's a judgment and we have to go through the process of exequatur of a foreign judgment. So what practical issues this have led? I think that there is no legal certainty of that such awards are going to be recognized and enforced in other jurisdictions. So as litigators, we need to think strategically if we're going to enforce that judgment decision under the New York Convention or if we're going to do it under a proceeding of an exequatur of foreign judgment. And I think that this can also be an incentive for foreign tribunals to recognize and enforce awards that were annulled in Guatemala. And I know that this is a huge debate in the doctrine that scholars haven't had a common criteria regarding the enforcement of awards that were previously annulled. But I think that since this is something so particularly in Guatemala, it's a domestic criterion that it can be possible for foreign tribunals to enforce an award that was previously set aside in Guatemala since it's a domestic criterion. So what have this led in also in the common practice in Guatemala is that parties waive their right to the annulment of the award. And recently in 2019, the Supreme Court of Justice and the Court of Appeals here in Guatemala have given validity to such waiver of rights. The Supreme Court of Justice didn't indicate that what requisites or formalities does that waiver has to do. It's valid only a simple declaration. You don't have to go to a public notary. You don't have to fulfill any type of requirements. It's a simple declaration that you have to make. So I think that I just wanted to conclude with this topic of the annulment of the award, that in order for Guatemala to be an effective seat of arbitration, it is not enough that we have UNCITRAL model law, and it is not enough that we are a state party of the New York Convention. Since this modification in the Guatemalan Arbitration Act of the annulment of the award makes a huge difference, that I believe that it does not make Guatemala an effective seat of arbitration. And I'm going to stop sharing screen because fortunately I got time to enter to the second topic, that are the constitutional actions of amparo. And differently from other countries like Spain, in Guatemala you have a constitutional action that parties can promote not only against decisions of public authorities, but also against decisions of private authorities, such as arbitral tribunals and arbitral institutions. So the reason why parties can promote a constitutional action of amparo is if they think that there is a resolution that affects their constitutional rights. So basically you have a motive to promote an amparo since the first resolution that the arbitral tribunal promotes. The problem with the constitutional actions of amparo is that they can last from 1 to 3 years, including the appeal in the constitutional court. So basically your arbitration is over before that you have a judgment of amparo. So the effect, the direct effect of promoting a constitutional action of amparo is not that important, since the amparo tribunal will not suspend or revoke a resolution of the arbitral tribunal on time. And just in the last minute I have, it's important to mention also that there is a due process paranoia in Guatemala. Parties tend to promote commonly actions of amparo. I'm not saying that in every arbitration you have, you're going to have an amparo, but it's something really frequently, and is more frequently when you have commercial arbitrations with the state parties. So I'm there for Guatemala, and thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Paulina, for your presentation. Definitely very important, again, for the time that we'll have later on, because you brought up first the question of setting aside, the grounds for setting aside, and the very peculiarities of Guatemalan position on this recurso de revisión. that the Supreme Court, that the usual model law adaptation has. I think it's also interesting, we will see amparo, as you know, is not a constitutional remedy only in Guatemala. So we may hear something about it in the founders of the amparo, which is Mexico, where we are moving now. Let me introduce you to Cecilia Azar, who is a partner at Galicia Abogados, where she has had an experience as an attorney, as well as a practitioner in complex domestic and litigation disputes. I also should mention that Cecilia's specialization is precisely in handling judicial proceedings related to arbitration before the Mexican courts, about which she will be mentioning today. And also her experience extends to issues of investor-state dispute resolution, to the extent that she has been appointed by the Mexican government as a conciliator in the exit disputes. And she serves also as the president of the Mexican Institute of Arbitration and the vice president of the ICC Commission in Mexico. Cecilia, we are hearing you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Garo. Thank you, Michael, for the organization. And thank you very much for the New York City, to the New York City Bar for the invitation. So I will address three different topics. The first one will be related to amparo, as we have mentioned. The second one to the authentication requirement for the enforcement of the arbitral award. And finally, I will mention a couple of ideas related to arbitrability and public policy. So the law governing arbitration proceeding in Mexico is contained in the Commerce Code, which incorporated the UNCITRAL model law in 1993 with minor modifications. The respective title of the Commerce Code applies to both domestic and international cases, as long as Mexico has been chosen as the seat of the arbitration. Additionally, as you probably know, Mexico is a member state of the New York Convention and of the Panama Convention, and we have signed 11 treaties that include a chapter on investment protection and about 30 bilateral investment treaties offering protection to foreign investors for over 45 nationalities of over 45 nationalities over the world. So in January 2011, the Mexican Congress modified the Commerce Code to include what we call a special trial for transactions and for commercial arbitration. So I'm gonna refer to this trial as the special trial. And this trial is applicable for setting aside an arbitral award, for recognizing an arbitral award, of course, for enforcing the award, and also for regulating cooperation or assistance from the judiciary to the arbitration proceeding. Having said that, one of the interesting discussions related to this special trial is which type of amparo is admissible to the final judgment of the trial. I'm not referring to the application of the amparo against the arbitral award. So far, the general criteria state that an arbitrator is not considered an authority for purposes of an amparo. I'm referring to the application or the admissibility of the amparo against the judgment that is resulting from the special trial, from a setting aside proceeding or for an enforcement and recognition proceeding. So the final judgment of the special trial is not subject to appeal, but in its capacity as an acto de autoridad, what we call an acto de autoridad under Mexican law, it can be subject to amparo, of course. In the last years, we have faced a discussion inside the Mexican courts on which type of amparo claim is admissible against that final judgment. And it could be a direct amparo or an indirect amparo. Those are the possibilities. And the discussion is relevant in terms of the duration of the amparo. So, of course, we don't have time to go through all the differences or similarities between the direct and indirect amparo.
But I would mention only the following. The direct amparo is uniinstancial. We call it uniinstancial, which means it's conducted on only one stage, while the indirect amparo is biinstancial. We have two stages. So we have the main stage of the amparo and a revision challenge against the decision of the amparo. So we have two steps or two stages. So of course it's longer. The indirect amparo is longer. So normally the direct amparo is admissible against final judgments judicial decisions on the merits of the dispute. And the dispute here, of course, is the setting aside of the award or the recognition of the award. Of course, not the dispute of the arbitration, the dispute of the special trial. So the direct amparo is admissible against judgment that will resolve the merits of the dispute. While the indirect amparo is admissible against non-judicial entities and against procedural judicial decisions. Not on the merits, but procedural decisions. So the indirect amparo trial is biinstancial. We have two stages. It is composed of two stages, and of course it's longer. The most recent criteria have determined that the indirect amparo is the appropriate one to challenge the judicial decision on the setting aside of the arbitral award or the enforcement of an award or the recognition of an award. And why is that? Because the court decided that the outcome of the special trial does not analyze the core issues of the dispute, but only analyzes whether the arbitral award meets or not the requirement for its enforcement. So they decided that the special trial decides a procedural matter and not a substantive matter. So they recently decided that the admissible one would be the indirect amparo, which provides a claimant with two new stages after the arbitration. So that is probably a decision we don't share. I mean, the arbitral community doesn't share, but in the end, that is something we have to face right now, and we have to litigate those two stages after the special trial. The second legal issue I would like to mention is related to the authentication requirements set forth in Article 4 of the New York Convention, and which is reproduced in Article 1461 of the Commerce Code. So the Mexican courts have been interpreting what should be understood by a duly certified copy of the award or an original version of the award. And since the concept of authentication is not defined or has not been defined in under Mexican law, the only concept we have is certification or certified copy. Courts have faced the need of discussing what needs to be understood by authentication. And we have the following two considerations or positions by two different courts. The first one says that the awards must be authenticated by a notary public, which means that the arbitrators need to ratify their signatures before a notary. But of course, could be pretty complicated for international arbitration. The other position states that for authentication, we only need to understand a certified copy of the original. And a certified copy is a document that is the same, a copy of the original one with the certification of a notary saying that this copy is identical to the original one, and that's it. Of course, we prefer the second position, which is more open to commercial cases and to lack of formalities. Fortunately, it seems, and I'm saying it seems because the court, the Supreme Court is analyzing both positions and deciding on the contradiction of both positions. And we know that the Supreme Court prefers the interpretation of authentication as a certified copy of the original award. I'm saying this because the decision of the Supreme Court hasn't been published. We know very recently the sense of the decision, but we have to wait to see the ratio of the decision to be able to determine whether the Supreme Court has determined which one of the position is best. But my sense is that we are going to move to the requirement of only a certified copy of the award and know the need. I mean, we won't need the ratification of the signatures by the arbitrators. And finally, the third and final legal issue I would like to mention refers to the concepts of arbitrability and public policy. So under Article 1457 of the Commerce Code, an arbitral award may be annulled when the judge verifies that under the Mexican law, the dispute was not subject to arbitration or the award was contrary to public policy. So although both concepts have been frequently discussed by Mexican courts, and generally speaking, the decision have been favorable to arbitration, those concepts remain broad and sometimes ambiguous in court's decision. These concepts are very important, and special attention must be paid in cases where one of the parties is the state or is an entity with state participation, like Pemex or like Comisión Federal de Electricidad, which is the Electricity Utility Commission. Why? Because normally in these cases where Pemex or CFE participate, both, they usually bring up arguments related to arbitrability and public policy. So that is why it is very important to keep in mind the meaning of these concepts. And again, these are issues that have been evolving under Mexican courts and remain very, very active and very ambiguous. So we still need to wait for some judicial decision to clarify the understanding and the scope of those concepts. So those are the three main aspects I wanted to address, and I will be, of course, open to questions and discussion. Thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, Cecilia. Certainly, all the hurdles that you mentioned about the enforcement of arbitration, foreign arbitration awards in Mexico are very important, as well as the constitutional remedy of amparo, again, which happens to have in Mexico a level of complexity not found, and sophistication, so to speak, not found in other jurisdictions, but I think it's important. But also you mentioned the issue of the state, where the arbitrations where the state is a party, given the cases of Pemex and the electricity company, and these have been mentioned also by other panelists, so we are likely to come back to this issue. But before doing that, let's move and cross the ocean and go to the Spain, where we have here Jesús Saracho, an associate from Uria y Menéndez in Madrid, who is part of the International Arbitration Department of that leading firm, Spanish firm. Jesús' practice has been focusing on international commercial and investment arbitration, and also had quite an experience in ICC and ICSID arbitrations. We will look forward to hearing you, Jesús, on your presentation on what you find within the Spain, the most relevant aspects of our developments of arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Garro, and thank you very much to the Inter-American Affairs Committee of the New York City Bar for the invitation to be here today, and also to its chair, to Michael Fernandez. I also would like to thank the rest of the sponsoring committees of the New York City Bar. And it is always an honor being back in New York, even virtually, and more so surrounded of this extraordinary group of colleagues and friends. And basically, the purpose of my intervention, I would like to explain in 10 minutes what U.S. and Latin American parties may encounter when dealing with arbitrations seated in Spain, or when they have to come to Spain to enforce an award. And I will try to stick to my time because I know that in this kind of event, respecting the time given is an use cogens obligation. Well, the first thing that it's important to note is that Spain is an arbitration-friendly jurisdiction. And this is not just a way of speaking. Spain, as a country, has made important efforts to modernize its legal system since the Spanish Arbitration Act was passed in 2003. This is an arbitration law inspired by the model law. And since then, the courts have generally displayed a pro-arbitration approach. And here I want to make a parenthesis, is that I would like to briefly explain that although many practitioners tend to confuse the fact that the Spanish Arbitration Act is inspired by the model law, it doesn't mean that it is exactly the same as the model law, as there are some differences. They are not very relevant and there are not many, but they do exist. And we are going here to mention three of them, for example. The first one is that in Spain, the arbitral proceedings are presumed to be confidential according to Article 24 of the Spanish Arbitration Act. And for example, the model law contains no provision in this regard. And the second difference is that the default rule, if the parties do not reach an agreement in Spain, requires a single arbitrator to be appointed rather than three. And we all know that according to the model law, shall be three. And the third point, and this is the most important one, if you are thinking of acting as arbitrators in Spain, is that arbitrators in Spain may incur in liability in the event of bad faith or gross negligence or willful act. As we say in Spanish, mala fe, temeridad o dolo, according to Article 21 of the Spanish Arbitration Act. And as we all know, the model law contains no provision on the liability of arbitrator for misconduct. And that's the reason why there is not a uniform approach. The second important thing that must be noted is that probably you already know it, is that Spain has been a contracting state to the New York Convention since 1977, and no reservation or declarations were made. So in Spain, the New York Convention applies to all the foreign arbitral awards, regardless of their nationality, as opposed to what happens, for example, in Guatemala. And I think that Paulina has just mentioned before. And I would like to share with you some figures. Well, first, according to the Primer Estudio de Arbitraje en España, published in 2018, by ICADE, my alma mater in Spain, commercial arbitration is increasingly seen as a means to resolve dispute at the international business level by 47% of the companies, of the Spanish companies that participated in this research. And the second important point in terms of the numbers is the key seats of arbitration in Spain, as you all may mind, are Madrid and Barcelona, and especially Madrid. And here I would like to bring your attention to an important figure. If we look at the ICC 2019 statistics, we can see that Madrid is the seventh most popular arbitration seat worldwide for ICC arbitrations. This is very relevant because Spain, or Madrid in this case, is getting close to cities like Zurich and New York. And it's already ahead of cities like Hong Kong, Sao Paulo, Doha or Dubai. I also wanted to mention the main Spanish arbitration institutions. There are three of them. Maybe you are already familiar with them or you have had experience with them. The Spanish Arbitration Court, based in Madrid. The Civil and Mercantile Court of Arbitration, also based in Madrid. And the Court of Arbitration of the Chamber of Commerce of Madrid, also based in the city. And what is also important to mention is that recently these three institutions and others joined efforts to create the Madrid International Arbitration Center. And this institution is aimed at resolving international arbitrations, especially involving parties from Latin America. And this institution is already working. It just started like several months ago, and we don't have a statistic yet. And all these institutions that we have mentioned offer a very professional service, are well-reputed, and are used to working with U.S. and Latin American parties, and of course with parties of other nationalities too. So you will not encounter any problems with working with them. And I would like to move to the issue of the setting aside of awards. Well, the first we have to say in this regard that the Spanish system is essentially the same as the legal framework created by the model law and the New York Convention. And looking at the latest statistics published by the Consejo General de la Abogacía Española, the General Council of Spanish Lawyers in 2019, the Spanish High Court of Justice, which are the competent courts, the Cortes Superiores de Justicia, resolved 38 setting aside actions in 2008, and 8 petitions for annulment were awarded. So the rate of annulment is around 20%. 5 awards were annulled because of a breach of public policy, and 3 of them were annulled because of the non-existent or invalidity of an arbitration agreement. One may think, in light of this number, that what I have just mentioned before is not the way I have presented it. Spain is not such a pro-arbitration jurisdiction. Nevertheless, it is important to have in mind when looking at this number that in around 63% of the cases in which the awards were annulled, the reason to annul the award was an expansive interpretation of the term of the concept of public policy made by a specific tribunal, el Tribunal Superior de Justicia de Madrid. And this expansive interpretation of the concept of public policy was recently criticized, and we could say corrected, by the Spanish Constitutional Court in a very important judgment of 15 June 2020, which we will try to analyze a little bit later if we have time. And moving to the enforcement of foreign awards, it is important to bear in mind that since 2012, 41 recognition proceedings of foreign awards have been initiated in Spain, of which the courts have recognized 38 and rejected 3. So the ratio of rejection is therefore of around 8%. And the reason most commonly alleged by the parties to oppose to the recognition of foreign arbitral awards in Spain, as you all can imagine, and probably this is something common in all the jurisdictions that we are discussing here today, is the breach of public policy. In Spain, and this is a very wide concept, is what we call a cajón desastre, that I don't really know how to translate the idea into the English. Maybe we could say like a catch-all term, or a one-size-fits-all. Is that when the parties don't know what to allege, they just mention they make use of the concept of public policy. And also, we'd like to share with you some news and trends regarding the Spanish market. The first thing I want to briefly explain the judgment recently handed down by the Spanish Constitutional Court and its implications. So it's a long story, but I'm just trying to focus on the takeaways, no? The important, the headline, the most important thing of the judgment. And the most important thing is that the judgment, this judgment basically has established that the interpretation of the concept of public order made by the Madrid High Court of Justice, the Tribunal Superior de Justicia de Madrid, that we have mentioned before as well, amounts, and I literally read, an extra limitation of its function, which is in breach of the party autonomy principle entering in the Spanish Constitution. So in essence, the Spanish Constitutional Court has confirmed beyond any reasonable doubt that the Spanish courts cannot revise the merits of a case under the excuse of public order when dealing with annulment proceedings. We could see that here the role of the Spanish Constitutional Court has been exactly the opposite to it seems to be in Latin America. And I couldn't finish this presentation without a brief mention to the Brexit, We foresee a relatively low impact in international commercial arbitration in Spain because, as you know, arbitration is not regulated by European Union law, and both the UK and Spain are signatories to the New York Convention, meaning that the enforcement of UK seated arbitral awards in Spain and Spanish seated arbitral awards in the UK will be unaffected. And the only thing is that maybe we have seen that are many companies moving their headquarters in Europe from the UK to Spain as a consequence of the Brexit. And therefore, we expect an increase of the cases seated in Madrid. And this process, in my opinion, will be incentivized by the fact that the fees of our colleagues in the UK are much higher than those of the Spanish lawyers. And as takeaways, I would like just to finish this presentation the same way as I started, emphasizing that Spain is already an arbitration-friendly jurisdiction, and it's working on its strength and trying to overcome its weaknesses to become not just a good arbitration jurisdiction, but a leader worldwide in this field, and especially regarding the Latin American world. So that is all, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jesus, for this presentation about Spain and its encouraging seat of forum for arbitration. We have, fortunately, a few minutes to before we go to the closing to actually discuss some aspects that have been touched upon by the panelists. None of the panelists had the time to really develop the many subjects that they have done. So it's definitely my duty to give them the floor to be able to expand. But I should give the priority to the audience, and we have already a couple of questions that I think are of concern or of interest to the audience. Well, the first one is addressed to Diogo. The second one is just generally a question about Latin America, with a specific reference to Mexico and Central America and its enforcement of awards there. And I will give that the floor to Paulina for that. So we'll first go to Diogo. And the question that I would like to paraphrase with doing justice to the questioner is concerning the two decisions that you mentioned, Diogo, by which the Superior Tribunal of Justice, the STJ, actually decided to denial and to refuse the enforcement of foreign arbitral awards in Brazil. Both of them had to do with the challenges to the members of the tribunal. And the question I would just quote from it, it says, could you elaborate on the grounds used by the court to refuse such enforcement, especially when even a green list conflict, he's referring to the IBA guidelines, seems to offend the letter of Article 14, Paragraph 1 of the Brazilian Arbitration Act, calling for the disclosure by the arbitrator of any fact that could imply his or her lack of impartiality or independence.
Wow. Well, the Abengoa case that I mentioned is the first case. It's a case from 2017 that was decided by the Superior Court of Justice. We could do a whole webinar just on the Abengoa case because it's a huge case. It has gone to a litigation in the U.S. with a U.S.-style discovery with a lot of documents. So it's a huge case. The other case is a case from the Court of Appeals of São Paulo, which... there's still an appeal pending, so the Superior Court of Justice will reassess the decision of the São Paulo Court of Appeals in the second case. But anyway, to keep a long, 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 long story short, what I can tell is that what the court decided is that as an arbitration has the nature of a contract where you are hiring the arbitrator to act in your case is not a state-appointed judge. So the arbitrator has to be bound to a higher degree than a regular judge. Although the Brazilian Arbitration Act says that there are the same rules for the judge and the arbitrator. But in those decisions, they mentioned that it's a higher standard than the stand to the judge. And they said that if the arbitrator lack the disclosure of facts that he should have disclosed, then the consequence is that the arbitral award is tainted and you can set aside the award or at least deny enforcement to the award. But both decisions do not make reference to the IBA guidelines. I am making those reference because for me, it stands out that as the IBA guidelines are a good guideline, the courts did not mention whatsoever the IBA guidelines. And they're not bound to do that. Not necessarily they should apply. But it's a good standard that, in my personal opinion, the courts in Brazil should have referred to.
Thank you, Joe. I think that the question and your response, as well as the response of the Brazilian courts to this issue, is really of a worldwide concern. As we can see, it's not only in Brazil where arbitrations has been, or where arbitral awards have been actually set aside because of this problem of impartiality, both in investment as well as commercial. I think I take it from your response a very important point, which is that arbitrators not being appointed by the state are certainly held to a higher standard of legitimacy and impartiality and independence. And this is certainly not surprising. It would be interesting to go over in the surveying the different arbitral institutions in the United States and abroad to see to which extent their practices conform to the IBA guidelines, which seem to be very useful to guide attorneys and judges, but definitely we all know is not binding. And the trend seems to be stricter and stricter just in order to safeguard the legitimacy of arbitration as a safe in model dispute resolution. So I think we may come back to this issue, but let me give now the floor to, first of all, quote the question that had been posed by one of our members of the audience. And he or she is asking about the tendency in Latin America in relation to the enforcement of awards, addressing disputes or deciding disputes from investors from abroad, especially from capital exporting countries, US, Europe, and Asia. And the question asks about how are the standards used in Mexico and Central America? Since we have Cecilia and Paulina who have been already discussing these issues, and both of whom already have been exposing the issues on what are the, let's say, the rate of enforceability, of how enforceable friendly one can find Guatemalan jurisdictions, especially specifically and Mexico. Let me start first with you, Cecilia. You already been discussing the issue of amparo and the question of the authenticity as potential hurdles for the speedy enforcement of awards. But the member of the audience wants to know, in general, how hospitable or hostile do you think are the Mexican courts to the enforcement of awards where one of the foreign parties involved?
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Garro. I agree. That's an interesting question. In my opinion, Mexico remains to be a friendly seat for arbitration, generally speaking. And in terms of enforcing awards, I think we have a high rate of enforceability, if we can say so. We have had a couple of polemic decisions. Decisions that refers to aspects of public policy, again, of waiver of some procedural aspect during the arbitration proceeding. For example, one important decision that was related to qualifications of the arbitrators during the appointment order of the tribunal. And those qualification or lack of qualification, although the parties participating in the composition of the tribunal, were the grounds for annulment afterwards. So that was a complicated decision long time ago. And those decisions have made enough noise to question how friendly the Mexican seat is for enforcement. But despite those decisions, who have been widely analyzed and discussed, I remain thinking that Mexico is a friendly and open forum for arbitration. Those are exceptional cases, Of course, it is important to have a Mexican lawyer dealing with the trial and dealing with the aspects I just mentioned, the amparo, the authentication of the award, aspects of arbitrability, public policy. But still, I mean, the Mexican judges follow the special trial set for in the Commerce Code, understand the reason set for in the New York Convention for denying the recognition of the award. So again, I insist. I think we remain being an open and friendly seat for arbitration.
Thank you, Cecilia. I think that part of the question, part of the concerns about enforceability of our foreign arbitral awards and enforceability of agreements may well have to do with the approach of the highest court in the country towards arbitration. And we have heard already Jesus Saracho mentioning about this unusual role of the Constitutional Tribunal in Spain, really going over and reversing the notion, the use of the notion of public policy by a highest court from Madrid in order to determine that the principle of party autonomy prevails. Well, as you know, in the Supreme Court in this country, which has a tendency also towards conservative approaches and towards pro-arbitration, has been extremely important in the development of the Federal Arbitration Act, both in the enforcement of arbitration agreement, mostly enforcement of arbitration agreements, more than in enforcement of awards. But in Mexico, there is a panel, I understand, of the Federal Supreme Court of Mexico handling these issues. And this panel has been deciding amparo actions for a long time in Mexico. And I would like to come back to you if we have time. But before, I want to hear Paulina on this issue of hospitality or hostility to awards. But I would like to know a bit, if we can, about the approach of the Supreme Court of Mexico. Paulina, you mentioned this very important provision amendment to the UCITRAL model law that made in Guatemala, when they speak about the revision action, which actually gives the judges the power to modify, revoke and modify an award, something unusual both in investment and in commercial arbitration, where we understand that setting aside, vacate, means to annul, means to avoid. That is to say, there's nothing has happened and you can go to an arbitration again. Now, if I understand correctly, the position of the Guatemalan Supreme Court, Paulina, is that the courts may review, modify the award and render a judgment. And you already expressed your concern about that. I haven't heard yet. I understand that this Supreme Court decision is still on appeal or before, or if I'm on the Constitutional Court of Guatemala, which is very powerful in amparo actions. Can you tell us a little bit about this issue, about the role of the Constitutional Court of Guatemala in the handling of amparo actions, and relating to the question of the audience, how hospitable are for the enforcement of awards the courts in Guatemala?
Yes, Professor, thank you. And I will be really short on the question of Alexander Gonzalez Castillo, because unfortunately, Guatemala is not an active region and Central America is not an active region in enforcing awards related to international investments and investors of other countries. And I can affirm that because we recently, in the law firm in which I work, we did a investigation in case law in the region in Central America, where we wanted to know how the courts were interpreting the grounds of the New York Convention. And we didn't have enough information because we believe that we haven't had in the region enough international arbitration cases in order for courts to enforce arbitral awards international. So that's basically my first answer. And regarding the Professor Garro question, the case law that I quoted from the Constitutional Court in 2015, it's the last case law we have regarding the interpretation of what the court shall modified, understood for modify or revoke. But the case law that is still pending of appealing the Constitutional Court is in order to determine if the courts will, in effect, adopt and be okay with the waiver of right for the annulment. I'm sorry. So that is the pending resolution we have. Approximately it will be this year because, like I said, an amparo action can last from 1 to 3 years. And the power that the Constitutional Court has in Guatemala regarding amparo actions is a huge power. Actually, most of the cases, and we have a huge doctrine related with third-party non-signatories when the state is involved, the Constitutional Court in several occasions through actions of amparo revoke the arbitral proceeding that has been guided by the parties. So it's the effect of the amparo. It's really important in arbitral proceedings since it can suspend or revoke all the actions that there have been done by arbitral tribunals and the parties.
Thank you very much, Paulina. I think that, do you have any hint about, given the composition of the Constitutional Court, how they could go along with the waiver of the right to annul? Meaning, if I understand correctly, the parties can completely waive any type of challenge against the award. And that, again, as you know, the international comparative experience is that really is very much unacceptable to the extent that there could be due process issues involved. There's always some escape valve left for the attention of the courts. But do you have any hint about how the Constitutional Court may go on this? Would they validate on the principle of autonomy as the Constitutional Court has done in Spain?
To be honest, I think they will not give validity to such agreements.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all the presenters. I think we have another question here, but the question precisely is addressed to Melida Hodgson. And the questioner, I will gonna give the question because first of all, I would introduce Melida to the audience. And she is the head of the General & Block's New York International Arbitration Practice. And Melida has been counseling governments and state-owned entities as well as corporations. And she has successfully defended countries in multi-billion dollar investment arbitrations in many areas of the industry. Melida, after this very brief introduction, of course, your curriculum, as all the other panelists, is much broader, but they can go to the flyer to read it. Let me quote the questioner, who is his concern about how much resistance, if any, have you seen in the U.S. courts in enforcing awards from Latin America, specifically from Brazil? Melida, the floor is yours. You can speak about all the aspects you want to talk about, but this was going to be an issue on which this questioner is very interested. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Professor Garo, and thank you to the organizers at the New York City Bar for Bar Association for inviting me to participate in this very interesting panel. I will get to answer the question that has been posed. It sort of naturally perhaps focuses on another country that's in the Americas, if not Iberoamerica. But I will answer that. I think first what I was asked to do was to sort of comment on what we've heard this evening. And so I will do that. And where I can, I'll note similarities also. And I think, you know, to end this panel out, I'll start with what Professor Garo said at the beginning, which is that this is, and obviously we all know, that Latin America is an incredibly diverse